This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, September 9th, 2003. This war on terrorism is bogus. That is the headline of an article in Saturday's Guardian in Great Britain, written by none other than British MP Michael Meacher from the Greater Manchester area. Michael Meacher, who has been serving as the Minister of the Environment from 1997 until June, when he resigned in protest. What he says is that the catalog of evidence about September 11th does fall into place when it's set against the Project for the New American Century blueprint. From this, it seems, Michael Meacher says, that the so-called, quote, war on terrorism is being used largely as bogus cover for achieving wider U.S. strategic geopolitical objectives.
What he calls, Maya, the ideal pretext to use force to secure U.S. global domination. The ideal pretext. Terrorism, the war on terrorism is bogus. The 9/11 attacks are a false flag, an ideal pretext. Michael Meacher, who was in fact the deputy leader, the shadow cabinet leader to replace Tony Blair, a longstanding leader of the Labor Party, no minor figure here, a longstanding member of the Blair regime itself, breaking ranks here, and for the first time setting forth in rather particularized outline the elements of the false flag operation of 9/11.
In fact, Michael Meacher, who was first elected in 1970, is one of Labor's longest-serving members of Parliament, and he even served in the Wilson and the Callaghan administrations in the 1970s. False flag operation. This is the term that Ralph and I used in our program 1 year ago, 9/11 false flag operation. Today's show, 9/11 and the capitalist state. Ralph?
The Meacher piece talks about a blueprint. We now know that a blueprint for the creation of a global Pax Americana was drawn up for Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Jeb Bush, Louis Libby, rebuilding America's defenses. The document of the Project for the New American Century is cited in great detail. And in this context, the delineation of how the capitalist state requires seizure of resources and engineered 9/11 as an opportunity for this. There is no minimizing the significance of this embrace of the work that has been done by so many. Notwithstanding our own initial broadcast in the days immediately following 9/11, World Trade Center Uncensored History, it is important that in Great Britain, at least, and it's interesting, by the way, I should mention that the Michael Meacher story, which is featured on the front, not the front page, but featured in The Guardian, has been virtually ignored in the United States.
Michael Meacher, as we have done and others, points to the fact that until July 2001, quote, the United States government saw the Taliban regime in Afghanistan as a source of stability in Central Asia that would enable the construction of hydrocarbon pipelines from the oil and gas fields in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, through Afghanistan and Pakistan to the Indian Ocean. But, he continues, confronted with the Taliban's refusal to accept U.S. conditions, the U.S. representatives told them, either you accept our offer of a carpet of gold or we bury you under a carpet of bombs.
This is the paradigm of how imperialism operates. There is something to be said that is of significance here. There has never been an imperial war that did not proceed under such pretext. And indeed, how imperialism functions is always in relation to the seizure of resources, the capture of markets, the subjugation of peoples who are sought for their cheap labor, while the resources of their respective countries are commandeered. It's the nature of the operation of capitalism on a global scale. It has been true for 100 years, and every nominal administration of the ruling class in the United States has implemented and pursued this agenda without exception. All of the major imperial wars have been contrivances in this regard. We have cited so often the legacy involved here, from blowing up the ship in the Havana Harbor, remember the Maine, to provide the pretext for the launching of war against Spain and the seizure of Cuba and the Philippines, to the sinking of the Lusitania, for the pretext for the U.S. to enter World War I and declare itself as the hegemonic imperial power prepared to challenge the prior colonial domains of England and Germany and France and Italy and Holland and Belgium and indeed Japan. Pearl Harbor, indeed, a pretext once again. The signals for the attack on Pearl Harbor known and already in the hands of the United States, the event itself having been precipitated by U.S. actions in the Pacific, the secret history of the Korean War, as I.F. Stone documented it so meticulously, when raids upon raids by covert operations were designed to precipitate a response for the North Koreans, the opportunity and occasion for a major U.S. war, to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, to the Bay of Pigs, to the events of the Gulf War itself. This is the paradigm in a way, this cabal, this 1% of our population that owns 90% of the national wealth, operates its global reach.
As Michael Meacher concludes, quote, "The conclusion of all this analysis," referring to the details of his article, "must surely be that the global war on terrorism has the hallmarks of a political myth propagated to pave the way for a wholly different agenda. The U.S. goal of world hegemony, built around securing by force command over the oil supplies required to drive the whole project." Let us look at what an insider said right after the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, September 11, 2001. This is General Gul Hamid. General Gul Hamid, the director of the Pakistani ISI, the intelligence services. Gul Hamid, who worked hand in hand with the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency to build the Terror Network that was used against the Taliban.
And actually, the ISI, the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency of Pakistan, was in fact a de facto government in Pakistan, along with selected generals in the military. The actual government, run by the Central Intelligence Agency, under its aegis, under its funding, under its control, under its direction, from virtually the inception of the Pakistani state. And Gul Hamid had not just been the head of the ISI, but he was the person who was involved in running the Al-Qaeda, in running the operations in Afghanistan that were the genesis of Al-Qaeda, the Islamic fundamentalist groups of bin Laden and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, funded by the Central Intelligence Agency, initially with $6 billion, rising to $40 billion, channeled through the ISI. Gul Hamid, the point man in all of this, the destabilization of the Soviet Union, the operation of what Brzezinski called the bear trap in his defining book on the strategy for engulfing the Soviet Union and drawing it into Afghanistan.
His book is called The Grand Chessboard.
And Gul Hamid is interviewed by the editor-at-large of United Press International, Arnold de Borsgrave, the former editor of Newsweek, Indeed, it was immediately in the aftermath of the attack on the World Trade Center that this stunning interview occurred. In an exclusive interview with United Press International, Gul Hamid was asked if there was a plot by anyone involved besides Osama bin Laden, and the response of Gul Hamid was shocking to Tibor's grave and extremely important and explicit. He said, "It is clear there was a plot by United States Air Force officers against the Pentagon and in conjunction with the Israeli Mossad. The Twin Towers were first attacked at 8:45 a.m. Four flights were diverted from their assigned airspace, yet Air Force jets didn't scramble, which is standard procedure, until 10 a.m. This is a small-scale rebellion, a coup. Radars are jammed, transponders fail, there is no IFF, there is no friend or foe identification challenge. This is an inside job." Now, who could have this have been? He said, "This will be hushed up in the investigation like the Warren report after the Kennedy assassination." And he indeed specifies how the U.S. Air Force was involved in the stand down. He lays it out in relation as well to the Mossad. A shocked Tibor's grave says to Gul Hamid, "But what about bin Laden, bin Laden?" And Gul Hamid comments, "From a cave inside a mountain, from a peasant's hovel, how do you think bin Laden would be able to mount so sophisticated an operation? Let us be serious."
"Let us be serious," Gul Hamid comments. "The Mossad and its American associates are the culprit. We ask, who benefits from the crime? Israel has a short shelf life before it is overwhelmed by demographics. The Palestinian movement cannot be put down. Israel has now handed to the Bush administration, with its acquiescence, the opportunity for which it has been waiting. And we might add, it's not that it's been waiting, it's an opportunity that the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, the Carter administration, U.S. administrations have been creating,
preparing
and creating until this moment, to consolidate America's imperial grip on the Gulf and to acquire control of the Caspian Basin,
says Gul Hamid,
by extending its military presence in Central Asia.
Gul Hamid states the Mossad and the United States accomplices in its intelligence services are involved here. The United States spends $40 billion a year on 11 intelligence agencies. I know this well. $400 billion in 10 years, and they say they were taken by surprise. Don't believe it. Within 10 minutes of the second Twin Tower being hit, CNN announced that Osama bin Laden had done it. Look, I'm in intelligence. This is a planned piece of disinformation by the real perpetrators. They are creating an instant mindset to put public opinion in a trance which prevents even intelligent people from thinking for themselves. We are talking about the Pentagon being struck, interdicted space. We're talking about the White House and no response. No challenge. This is an inside job, says Gul Hamid.
And Gul Hamid is specific about why this took place at the moment of September 11, 2001. He states, quote, "All summer long, we've heard about America's shrinking surplus, that the Pentagon will not have sufficient funds to modernize. Presto! All of a sudden, the Pentagon can get what it wants without any opposition. How very convenient. Even your cherished civil liberties," he says to Tibor's grave, "will be abridged with impunity.
To protect the expansion of the hegemony of transnational capitalism."
Let us look now at the reality of the oil story. Missing the oil story was an article by Nina Berlay, who was written for The Washington Post, The Chicago Tribune, and New York Magazine, and as a reporter for Time Magazine, was one of the first U.S. journalists to enter Iraq after the first Gulf War. Missing the oil story. She reports about former President Bush, who was an ex-CIA director, and the Washington Carlyle Group, the $12 billion equity firm that employs a motorcade of ranking Republicans such as Frank Carlucci, Jim Baker, and Richard Darman, who were senior Bush senior's colleagues and have opened the doors overseas for the Carlyle Group's access to capitalists. Now, Charles Ritchie of the Washington-based Center for Public Integrity also points the figure to state power in capitalist America and the war drive that they require. Also, look at the financial benefit to George W. Bush, Jim Baker, and the other oil interests. The Oil and Gas Journal had pointed out that Central Asia by the year 2050 could account for 80% of U.S. oil imports. Now, this is the Oil and Gas Journal. As Nina Berle had been writing, we need, quote, unimpeded access to the stands, by which she means Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Tajikistan, for our oil people, our geologists, our pipelines, if we are to realize the future outlined by Vice President Dick Cheney.
The London Times defense editor Michael Evans published an article on the 20th of September 2001 revealing what he called secret plans for a 10-year war, secret plans to launch this war under the rubric of Operation Noble Eagle, plans long in preparation, plans with a timetable, plans as the article sets forth, waiting for its moment of opportunity to be launched. Indeed, Nayaz Nayak, the former Pakistani foreign secretary, was told by senior American officials in mid-July of 2001 that the military operations for the seizure of Afghanistan, as the BBC reported, were already prepared to proceed no later than the middle of October. The Carnegie Endowment called for a study on Central Asia on the periphery of a new global war. And in this rather important report, they say, and this is preceding 9/11, our target is Central Asia's Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. The assessment reflected the thinking of the major intelligence agencies and their think tanks for over a decade. The Caspian Sea Library boasted reports by Brzezinski and Colin Forsyth Hussein. The participants in those discussions were Robert Abernathy, the president of America's Standard Development, Daniel Burkos, Cambridge Energy Research Associates, Matthew Burrows of the Council on Foreign Relations, N.J. Buckler of British Petroleum, Amoco, Ariel Cohen of the Heritage Foundation and the Council on Foreign Relations, Nomi Colton Facts of Global Oil and the Pure Energy Group, and Fred Coote of the Energy Analysis for the Central Intelligence Agencies. Contributors were the International Energy Resources Analyst, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Mobile Corporation, Rand Corporation, Exxon, Bell Atlantic, Goldman Sachs, the James Baker Institute, the Nixon Center, the Journal of Commerce, the First International Oil Corporation, the Petroleum Research Foundation, Chevron Overseas Petroleum, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the Energy Intelligence Group, the Petroleum Finance Company, and Texaco, a who's who of the ruling class, and this but the first of a series of such conferences preparing for a strategic plan, the seizure of oil in the region, and calculating the benefits of $4 to $5 trillion in short-term profit.
As John J. Maresca, the Vice President of International Relations of UNICAL, stated before the Congressional Committee on Asia and the Pacific on February 12, 1998, he said, 100 years ago, Central Asia was the arena for a great game played by Tsarist Russia, colonial Britain, and Napoleon's France, and the Persian and Ottoman empires. 100 years later, he specified, the collapse of the Soviet Union has unleashed a great game where the interests of the East India Trading Company have been replaced by those of UNICAL and SoCal. Let's look at the Wall Street Journal, September 5th, 2003, just a few days ago, with a banner headline, bigger Kazakh oil output is gold. $10 billion investment to spur production in a huge field. Reporting from Paris, Bhushan Bari, the Wall Street Journal reporter, states an international consortium of energy companies plans to increase to $10 billion its initial investment in a giant petroleum project in Kazakhstan in order to produce more oil from the deposit, the largest known oil field outside of the Middle East. It involves Eni, ExxonMobil, Royal Dutch Shell, Total, ConocoPhillips, and Japan's Inpex. And the Kashagan oil field is the largest discovery in four decades. Caspian Sea project will produce 1.2 million barrels a day, second only to Saudi Arabia's gargantuan Ghawar field, the world's largest.
Maya Maresca is very, very specific in setting forth the objectives here. There are tremendous untapped hydrocarbon reserves. To give you an idea of the scale, the proven natural gas reserves are equal to over 236 trillion cubic feet. The region's total oil reserves will exceed 60 billion barrels of oil in the short term. Our estimates are as high as 200 billion barrels. In 1995, the region produced 870,000 barrels. By 2010, we will increase this production by seizure to 4.5 million barrels a day by an increase of 500%. Our major objective has to be to gain control and secure the region's vast energy resources and to get them to the markets where they are needed. The consortium of 11 foreign oil companies that set forth here, which include Unocal, Amoco, Exxon, and Pennzoil, is almost a replica of the San Remo agreements of April 24, 1920, when the European powers and the United States carved up the Middle East and decided on the percentages of oil they would own and exploit. We contemplate the pipeline south from Central Asia to the Indian Ocean, and we have Afghanistan as the single most significant target of short-term opportunity. This, as Mitra says, is a blueprint. It is an absolutely clear, explicit Mein Kampf. The World Policy Journal carried this study in the spring of 1998 by Ian Bremmer, Oil Politics, America, and the Riches of the Caspian Basin. He is virtually salivating. Quote, we can barely measure the Caspian wealth. The proven oil reserves range to 30 billion, comparable to those of the North Sea. And he proceeds to replicate the estimates of Maresca. The Heritage Foundation, which is, by the way, not just an arena for the Central Intelligence Agency and the Mossad, completed this study by Ariel Cohn on July 24, 1997, U.S. policy in Central Asia, creating the new Silk Road. He proceeds to table estimates of the recoverable oil and gas resources and to provide a timetable for their seizure. All of these think tank reports of the ruling class, from Amoco and British Petroleum, from Chevron to Atlantic Richfield, to the American companies that are being assimilated to the plan of dividing it up, are testifying, are preparing the groundwork for seizure, for direct military seizure of these resources. How to accomplish this without a major pretext?
Ralph, that's why the Wall Street Journal article of September 5th is so significant.
Of this year.
Of this year, just a few days ago. Because once the Soviet Union was broken up, and now the process is to control Afghanistan, to make it secure in order to have the pipeline built that will get the oil more easily to the market, the investment is taking place. And the oil fields are being exploited, not just the Tengiz oil field where Chevron Texaco has been pumping oil, that's a Kazakh field, but now this new field, the Kashagan field, the largest discovery in four decades. The problem and the reason for the war, the assault against Afghanistan, the breakup of the Soviet Union to control the Central Asian oil, and now to be able to secure a pipeline, is because It is very difficult to get the oil from Kazakhstan out to market. They either have to build a pipeline under the Caspian Sea, which they haven't been able to do, or what they're going to do now is to build a port and then tanker the oil to Baku in Azerbaijan and then have another pipeline to Ceyhan in Turkey. Not as efficient as it would be going through Afghanistan. And this is where Afghanistan comes up again. It's very clear Afghanistan is a small piece of a war, top U.S. brass say. It was a headline. And the rest of it was, Afghanistan is only a small piece of the U.S. campaign that could last more than a lifetime. It was Air Force General Richard Myers, who is chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, who said on ABC This Week in October of 2001 that, quote, he had started to prepare targets in Iraq. This is a global war on terrorism, Richard Myers said, and weapons of mass destruction. Afghanistan is only one small piece. Of course, we're thinking very broadly. Since World War II, we haven't thought this broadly about a campaign. Afghanistan, Iraq, played out for the world domination of resources. Ralph?
Maya, in the immediate aftermath of the Gulf War, we published a book called Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed. In that book, we documented how, quote, since 1964, every United States administration is prepared for direct seizure of Arab oil out of the conviction that the country-selling regimes cannot last, that mass pressure will inevitably transform social relations, thus jeopardizing the flow of capital. Robert Tucker, reflecting these concerns in U.S. business circles, addressed the technical feasibility of seizing Arab oil fields by direct military intervention. Quote, oil, the issue of American intervention. It was a think tank piece that had been prepared for the Pentagon. It was published in commentary in January 1975. Quote, without intervention, there is a distinct possibility of an economic and political disaster bearing more than a superficial resemblance to the disaster of the 1930s. And he describes this area that has to be seized as, quote, the Arab shoreline of the Gulf, a new El Dorado awaiting its conquistador. And indeed, Harper's Magazine then published an analysis called Seizing Arab Oil by Miles Zignotis, identified as a Pentagon consultant with, quote, intimate links to high-level U.S. policymakers. What was set forth in 1975 was the blueprint for Operation Desert Shield. And the National Security Council compiled a detailed review of a top-secret Department of Defense plan to invade Saudi Arabian oil fields to displace the Saudi monarchy. The plan, codenamed Dahran Option 4, was drawn up by the Pentagon, providing for a U.S. attack on the oil fields of Ghawar, containing, quote, 40% of the world's known oil reserves. It's detailed. It will be led by nine airborne infantry battalions based in North Carolina, flown under escort to Dahran in the Gulf by way of the Israeli air base at Hatzarim. And indeed, in August 1975, Saudi oil fields and Arab oil fields as military objectives, the feasibility study, prepared jointly by Colonel John Collins, a senior specialist in national defense with 18 years in contingency planning for the Pentagon, and by Clyde Mark, analyst for the House Committee on International Relations. These are long-standing invasion plans, as I state, all in preparation since 1964. By August 25, 1977, President Carter issued a secret presidential directive, PD-18, calling for the preparation of a strike force of several divisions for rapid intervention in the Middle East and in the oil-producing areas of the Gulf. Indeed, the preparations that had been made by every American administration since 64, Democratic and Republican alike, were simply waiting for the moment of opportunity to implement this military plan with all of the elements and the forces involved, mobilized, training, and at the point of go. By 1979, Lawrence Mosher formulated the plan, quote, circulating in Washington corridors. What military people call the U.S. 100,000-man quick strike force consisting of multiple divisions deployable in air will begin. But what we need is a real boogeyman to come in and have to be stopped before we can sell our strike force. It may turn out that that boogeyman may not be defined the same in Arabic as in English, unquote. This was subsequently published in Middle East International on January 19th, 1979. Brothers and sisters, the blueprint, the preparation, the contingency plans, all in place. Every administration, this is the capitalist state, defining its own crisis by its need, its dependence, first of all, on military production to sustain a capitalist economy in rapid decline because of the falling rate of profit. No longer can they even afford the compradors, the feudal elites, the pass-throughs, the vehicles for flight capital on which capitalism has always depended. They want to eliminate their cut. They're going to seize direct control. The preparations are all there. And 9/11 is but the little continuation of the normal operations of the capitalist state in a period of advanced and degenerative decline. The crisis of the permanent war of World War IV is the crisis of imperialism. 9/11, the false flag operations, are the expression of that crisis.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, 9/11 and the Capitalist State. This is WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial and in New York and on the internet, www.wbai.org. I'd also like to mention our programs are archived at our website, www.takingaim.info. The other day, on Sunday, President Bush went before the people of the United States, and it was telecast throughout the world, stating, quote, "Nearly 2 years ago, following deadly attacks on our country, we began a systematic campaign against terrorism." Terrorism, a war on terrorism, when in fact the true terrorists are the capitalist state, is the capitalist state itself, and the administrations that serve it. Historic conferences organized by none other than Benjamin Netanyahu, who was later to become the Prime Minister of Israel, created the ideological foundation for permanent war and this category of terror that is used by President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and Secretary of State Colin Powell and all the people who serve them. It creates the ideological foundation for the assault against Afghanistan, the assault against Iraq, for permanent war, the huge military budgets, the cutbacks of the social services here in the United States. Among those in attendance at the second international gathering, the first having taken place in Tel Aviv, the second international gathering, June 24, 1984, nearly 20 years ago, in Washington, D.C., was U.S. Secretary of State George Shultz, then Secretary of State, Congressman Jack Kemp, Senators Alan Cranston, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, then FBI Director William Webster, former UN Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick, Israeli officials Moshe Arendt, who had served as the Minister of Defense and Israel's ambassador to the U.S., Yitzhak Rabin, who was then Minister of Defense and had been Israel's Prime Minister and ambassador to the United States, as well George Bush, and prominent journalists who went on and to this day promote the agenda of a war against terror. Specifically, Ted Koppel of ABC TV, Bob Woodward of The Washington Post, and also Charles Krauthammer of The Washington Post, Daniel Shore of CBS TV and CNN, and Norman Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, as well as George Will and Arno de Borsgrave of The Washington Times.
Maya, the category of terror was the ideological replacement for the war against communism, for indeed the challenge to revolution and to what was called communist subversion the entire rationale for the dependence of capitalism on a permanent military economy was served by the struggle against revolutionary transformation in the world, the struggle against resistance to a colonial design, the struggle against national independence movements, the struggle against those who sought to gain control of their own resources, the struggle of the oppressed in this century. Actually, in fact, the pursuit of this agenda has been really a little continuation of the crisis of capitalism since the 1930s. For at the time of the Great Depression, the percentages of those who were unemployed were vast, and the percentages of those employed in arms production in the military were minuscule. The crisis of capitalism was most expressed during the second term of Franklin Roosevelt, when the unemployed had exceeded even those under Herbert Hoover. And indeed, this was reversed through one modality of transformation, the pump priming through massive military production. With the military production in preparation for a second global imperial war, those numbers were reversed. The percentages of those now employed by the military were equivalent to the previous unemployed figures, and those in the military, that small percentage prior to the military buildup, now corresponded to what had previously been the percentages of unemployment. The dependence of capitalism on military production, ever increasing like an attic needs its fix, has been a hallmark of capitalism ever since. The military-industrial complex, as Eisenhower would call it, is nothing more than the crisis of capitalism no longer able to engage in productive forces wholly dependent on waste production of the ever-increasing arms economy. That is the sine qua non of the survival of capitalism in the short term at the enormous cost of massive immiseration, permanent war, covert operations, a criminal enterprise based upon the seizure of every available modality of functioning a murder state, drug dealing, and the laundering of funds through banks, the securing of huge trillions of dollars in offshore accounts, all of this flowing of the from the dependence of the capitalist state on military outlook and military dependence and production. This articulated most clearly in a document prepared by the Mossad in the late 1970s. It was called A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s. It was a blueprint for imperialism itself. It claimed that it was necessary now to fragment each Middle Eastern country in its term, and it was very specific in laying out which would come first. Iraq was targeted, Egypt was targeted, Saudi Arabia was targeted. These would be broken down into original ethnic and religious components in order for their resources to be seized directly and for their governments to be displaced on a permanent basis. This is indeed the agenda that informed the category of terror as the replacement and the ideological integument for the sustaining of the military production that the collapse of the Soviet Union put into doubt. Netanyahu did not function alone in his capacity as the organizer of conferences to engage U.S. imperialism in a permanent war on terror. Indeed, the Israeli publication Ha'ir documented that Benjamin Netanyahu was a high-level central intelligence operative with four different social security numbers operating in the United States under the name of John J. Sullivan and John J. Sullivan Jr., as set forth in both the Jerusalem Post and in Ha'ir, July 4, 1996, a detailed delineation of the function of Netanyahu on behalf of Central Intelligence in preparing the conferences and in orienting U.S. imperialism towards a permanent war on terror. In relation to 9/11, which is what we are going to be focusing on in the remainder of this program, there was a seminal article on the front page of the New York Times, the Sunday edition of the New York Times, which referred to the role of the neocons, and in particular of Paul Wolfowitz, called The Sunshine Warrior, September 22, 2002, in which at a meeting of the General Staff of the United States Army, presided over by the Chief of Staff of the Army, General Eric K. Shinseki, Shinseki stated that all of the preparations for the intervention had been made in the 1970s, and indeed the people associated with the American Enterprise Institute, with the Project for the New American Century, the people associated with the Likud in Israel, the Wolfowitzes, the Pearls, the Libbys, were in preparation for this since 1977. The Sunshine Warrior is a setting forth, an explicit acknowledgement of the preparations for a war on terror on along the lines of the seizure of resources as Wolfowitz and the Likudniks and the integration of the Mossad and the Israeli strategy for American imperialism became the paradigm for the pursuit of the imperial agenda on a global scale.
Ralph, I think we should look at how these so-called terror networks are set up. And one person who is a master at this is Rafi Eitan. Rafi Eitan, who in of the Israeli intelligence service, who has served for over 25 years. And according to Richard Sale, the UPI intelligence correspondent, writing in July of this year, he said that Rafi Eitan is resurfacing in the United States, that in fact Rafi Eitan has been taken out of retirement, if he had ever been placed there, by Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Eitan had been the director of the Office of Special Tasks called LACEM, and it's a group in the Israeli Defense Ministry. And, incidentally, he was the man who recruited Jonathan Pollard in the spy network, where Pollard transferred 850,000 secret documents to the Israelis. Eitan also orchestrated the Achille Lauro affair that was attributed to the Ahmed Jibril sector of the...
Well, these are false flag operations, and they are a paradigm of the way in which imperialism operates, and we will relate this, of course, to 9/11 in particular. But the false flag operation, as you describe it, Maya, and as was exposed by Ben Menashe, involved the carrying out of terror acts in the name of people you want to target. But in fact, the Achille Lauro operation, and in which a pleasure boat was seized and its passengers held hostage, and an elderly Israeli man in a wheelchair, Leon Klinghoffer, thrown overboard, was a black operation orchestrated by Rafi Eitan, as documented by Ben Menashe in his book. It was one of a series of such operations, further delineated by Viktor Ostrovsky in his book, The Other Side of Deception. A Rogue Agent Exposes the Mossad's Secret Agenda is the name of this book. And in this book, as we documented in our previous shows, it is established that Rafi Eitan and the Mossad were involved in the blowing up of the Berlin discotheque. They were involved in the planned operations against U.S. embassies in Kenya and in Tanzania. And indeed, these were imputed to terrorist others and to Libya in the example of the Berlin discotheque bombing, La Belle Discotheque. The Operation Trojan that Ostrovsky delineates and that we set forth in our broadcast last week involved the planting of equipment in Tripoli, which then sent signals to embassies, presumably planning for assassinations and for terror operations, which were indeed Mossad operations themselves. These then exposed subsequently not only by Ostrovsky, but by German public television and by the German publication Frontal. This is the modality of the gangster state, the integration of the Israeli instrument of imperial policy in the region and imperialism's operations themselves. From the Achille Lauro to the Berlin discotheque in 1986, Rafi Eitan, as was disclosed again by Ostrovsky, made arrangements to blow up an El Al plane and to attribute this operation to Syria. the penetration of Hezbollah by Rafi Eitan and the Mossad, so that particular terror acts imputed to the Hezbollah and to the Syrians and the Iranians were, in fact, false flag operations. This is the method through which the ruling class whips people into hysteria over the false category of terror. 9/11 is a very specific manifestation of that same modality.
Ralph, in referring to the Israelis and the method of setting up terror operations, the false flag operations, which also is the modus operandi of the CIA, and often the CIA working in conjunction with the Israeli intelligence operations, the Mossad in particular. J. Michael Waller and Paul Rodriguez, on May 5, 2000, as early as that, wrote an article on Israeli bugging of the White House in their magazine Insight. And in it, they specify Amdocs. Amdocs is a major company, unknown to us, but that affects each and every person in the United States, in that Amdocs, this major Israeli company, provides the computer collection, the data collection of telephone calls. As you, when you get your telephone bill, you, particularly for the long distance calls, you will see that the calls are recorded. Who called, who you called. And all this information is compiled by Amdocs. And it turns out that in providing this and in providing the hardware by a company called Comverse, another Israeli company, which provides the hardware, and Amdocs provides software, that these companies were working with not only the White House, but the Department of Justice and the Department of State. And in May of 2000, after a year-long investigation, Michael Waller and Paul Rodriguez concluded that the FBI that had been tracking this operation to spy on high-level U.S. officials had been hacking into what was supposedly secure telephone networks.
That's the tip of the iceberg. It's not just a spy operation through Amdocs and Converse and Promise, which monitors all telephonic communications, including those of the intelligence agencies, but it's the operation of an entire spy network within the United States. Indeed, with reference, Maya, to the operations of Rafi Eitan, in the most recent disclosures about Rafi Eitan, it is made clear that he is now 15,000 what are called Sayanim, or operatives in the United States, 15,000, and that they are preparing a follow-up of 9/11. This is a disclosure that has been set forth in some rather meticulous detail.
By Gordon Thomas, who has written extensively about the Mossad and other intelligence operations, and also the description of the Sayanim, which are the helpers, that's the Israeli word for help, was detailed by Victor Ostrovsky in By Way of Deception. As Ostrovsky says, there are thousands of Sayanim around the world. In London alone, there are about 2,000 that are active and another 5,000 on the list. And Gordon Thomas says that now there are 15,000 in the United States. Ostrovsky writes, a car Sayan, for example, runs a rental agency that helps the Mossad rent a car without having to complete the usual documentation. And a doctor Sayan would treat a bullet wound without reporting it to the police. The idea is to have a pool of people available when needed who can provide services but will keep quiet about them out of loyalty to the cause.
Maya, United Press International intelligence correspondent Richard Sale reported, Rafi Eitan, the Israeli spy master who recruited Jonathan Pollard to spy on the United States, has reemerged in American soil, and according to federal law enforcement officials, he is traveling on the United States on an Israeli passport using an alias. In a follow-up to the UPI story on August 7th, Sale wrote, Eitan, described by former Israeli officials as being sidelined in mothballs, as in fact in active operation. And indeed, it is a description of a clandestine trip to the United States to activate 15,000 operatives for preparations for a follow-through on 9/11. Eitan is the former chief of Mossad operations in Europe. He landed at Columbus, Ohio, and moved around the Midwest, involved in the coordination of the Israeli organized crime figures who control, as sale documents, 70% of the worldwide market in ecstasy. For his part in the Pollard spy scandal, he was promoted to a senior position with the largest state-owned business enterprise in Israel, the Israel Chemicals Company. He received the job based on the recommendation of Ariel Sharon. But the operation in the United States that we are describing here, 15,000 operatives, is an explicit setting forth of plans for new 9/11-like operations in the United States to provide further rationale for the war on terror. And the articles by Richard Sale and the articles in Washington Times and the articles in the United Press International not only set forth the past operations, but detail the particularity of what is intended in the future. And this follows rather closely on the exposures in a four-part series by Fox News on Israeli spies in the United States. It goes to the issue of the relationship of the Mossad to the events of 9/11, the exposure of what was called the White Van by ABC News and in the New York Post, and the Urban Moving Company. Millions, as ABC News reported, who saw the horrific images of the World Trade Center, and those who saw them won't forget them. But New Jersey homemakers saw something that morning that prompted investigations into Israelis and their connection to Israeli intelligence. There were men taking video of the World Trade Center in the background. They were, in fact, there for hours prior to it. The plate number on their van was traced to a company called Urban Moving Company. The van was spotted on a service road near Route 3. They were all high-level Israeli intelligence officers. The FBI searched Irving Moving's headquarters for hours, removing boxes of documents and computer hard drives. They were all connected to Israeli intelligence and to military intelligence. Indeed, the white van was the tip of the iceberg, because the Israelis were not just operating in New Jersey in relation to filming of the World Trade Center. There were traces of explosives in the van, and indeed the dogs that were sniffing the van indicated that the explosives had been in that van and had been removed, but shortly prior to that, the white van was a correlate of another discovery. As reported in the Philadelphia Mercury on the 17th of October, 2001, an article by Michel Moad, men described as Middle Eastern were detained by federal immigration figures authorities after being found with detailed footage of the Sears Tower in Chicago. Plymouth police encountered the men after officers responded to Pizzeria Uno on the 1000 block of West Ridge Pike, and they observed the vehicle's preparations and operations. The registration number of the tractor trailer was to Moving Systems Incorporated, and what was determined there were preparations for the taking out of Sears Tower. Indeed, the Sears Tower video that was found in Pennsylvania replicated the discoveries with respect to the white van and the Irving Moving System. And the INS signed papers that allowed the detention of these Israelis, and the question was posed. The fourth plane that was in Ohio when it turned around and crashed in Pennsylvania appeared to be on a course heading for the Sears Tower before its abrupt turn over Ohio. The particulars about the white van and the Philadelphia Mercury the detailed delineation of the spy operations of the Mossad, over 200 operatives, 60 of them based in Hollywood, Florida, within houses of Mohammed Atta, with whom they had not only been in contact but had been monitoring over a period of time, sustain the evidence regarding the role of the Israelis and the Mossad in the events of 9/11.
So when the FBI issues an alert on Friday, September 5th, that four al-Qaeda suspects may be engaged in another hijack plot, quote, the alert came a day after the Homeland Security Department issued a warning that al-Qaeda could be targeting commercial aircraft flying over or near the continental United States. And the timing is not coincidental, said one official, referring to the FBI bulletin that had also been released. Not coincidental, of course, because on Sunday, President Bush made his presentation before the people of the United States to give a reason for an $87 billion appropriation to continue his war on terror, which, incidentally, the Democratic members of Congress have said they would also support. Now we can see that the supposed hijackers, the supposed terrorists, and the new list that the FBI and the Homeland Security Department are setting out an advisory about may not be the real perpetrators of these events. They are the fall guys. They are the people who were set up by the intelligence operations. Next week, what we will go into are the smoking guns of 9/11.
When we will detail the military training of Mohammed Atta, the way in which the United States Intelligence Service and German Intelligence Services ran Mohammed Atta and his colleagues in Hamburg, the role of the Mossad in this as well, the particularities of the false flag operation of 9/11, the structure of the capitalist state in pursuit of its murderous agenda.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We will be with you next week. You can reach us at 212-209-2953 or at 707-552-9995. Our email is takingaim@pacbell, that's PACBELL.net. And our website is www.takingaim.info. Our programs are available in cassette and CD form, and also they are on our archive on our internet site. We'll be with you next week.
You guys are done, I say. Hello? Hello? Hello?